Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it.
Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life in Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. June is Indigenous History Month. On June 21st, it is National Aboriginal Day. It is for these significant commemorations that today's show has a special guest. Rick Beaver, an artist, elder, and conservationist living in Alderville, will share his personal recollections of Alderville, plus he will give insight into the Indigenous life celebrated in his art and conservation activities. I'm so pleased to have with me today Rick Beaver, artist, elder, and conservationist living in Alderville. Welcome to Consider This. Rick, lots of things I want to talk to you about today related to local Indigenous history, but I want to start with some personal history. What is your earliest memory of Alderville when you were a kid?
Oh, I've always been interested in nature, and of course, many of my relatives live here, so I rely upon memories of them for introductions to many aspects of that. Running around here as a knock-kneed boy, catching frogs and butterflies and going fishing and hunting with them in later days. And I suppose, you know, being out in the country as Alderville is, the opportunities for experiences in the natural world are plentiful, I'll put it that way. And I took full advantage of them, the streams, the rivers, of course, Rice Lake, and the hills and forests of the surrounding countryside, too, as well. So my memories are founded strongly in those areas, and they're pretty visual for me, you know, and in later days, relatives would take embarrassing videos of me running around the corner of a house with a butterfly net and feeling somewhat cheapened at being caught in the act. So those kind of things important to me. And, of course, family living off the reserve for a great part of the year. My father was a professional electrical engineer. He followed the course of his profession abroad through Ontario and other locations, and coming back to Alderville was a big deal for me. Summer vacations, weekends were very memorable things. So I lived in my grandparents' place, Amos and Mabel, and it was a place with no indoor plumbing, no running water, but an abundance of other amenities which were not achievable or obtainable anywhere else. Listening to meadowlarks in the spring and the Easter holidays outside the door, and catching suckers in the stream that flowed past their house. Things like that, very important to me.
In those early days, what was your sense of living in the community of Alderville? What was it like? What kind of things did you do for fun? Were there special events that went on that you can remember? Can you share some of that with us?
Well, yeah, there were always the Sunday school picnics where everybody came and participated in things like shoe kicks and foot races, egg tosses, that kind of thing. There was the Alderville Regatta, which my uncle Glenn Crow initiated many, many years ago. He's unfortunately no longer with us, having passed away recently. Always a great canoeman, and did a lot for the young people who wanted to participate in an outing, a community outing on the shores of Rice Lake in a property called Thimmy Ridge that was purchased by the community after it was established as a First Nation. And in terms of doing things growing up as a teenager, there was always riding around in cars. It was going down to the lake. There was boating on the lake, fishing, trapping and hunting with my relatives, my uncles. We played a lot of horseshoes, games which didn't require a great deal of expenditure and were commonly practiced then, as they are now. And we have, within our community still, we have some very, very proficient horseshoe pitching players. So those things were the order of the day back then. And of course, mostly it was walking around, going to the small corner stores, which were frequently found in adjacent areas like Sandra Cox Camp on the lake, in Roseneath. And like that, it was mostly pretty low-key stuff, actually. And of course, all of the other outings that are oriented toward family, with the family, on summer vacations, coming down, renting a cottage on Rice Lake and spending really very memorable times there. Experiencing the natural wonders and the things that didn't occur when you lived on high and dry land, for instance. So, things like that.
It is often said by Indigenous people that they hold a strong tradition towards the preservation and protection of the land. Now, this relationship is considered by some to be a sacred one as well. Was that relationship a conscious part of your decision to pick biology and zoology for your advanced studies?
Well, I think initially, you know, the experiences of being out on the land with my family, my father, and my mother, my brothers and sisters, in areas like wild rice harvesting, we always had a canoe around the house. We paddled a lot. We explored a lot. Wherever my father worked, of course, in the earlier years, we followed him. But those activities were always in the forefront of things we did as a family. And even though, you know, our absence from the reservation and this so-called dissonance, I guess, that occurred with respect to the practice of traditional culture, the language, the dance, the songs were things that had been drummed out of Indigenous society in the years and generations previously. Those came later to me. But the environmental connection was there as a personal experience, and in the scientific community, the impression that I got was that it needed some attention, and it still does today. I still believe that there are very strong issues in front of us that affect our environment, climate change being first and foremost about, and I guess it's concomitant to issues of species extinctions. And then the miraculous and fortuitous return of an interest by our young people in their language, their customs, their traditions, further consolidated that belief in the necessity for participating actively in environmental stewardship came in, where I learned that the first lesson creation given to us. First of all, we're to be good people. Just be good people, kind, generous, considerate, respectful to one another. To extend that to the natural world, to be kind, considerate, respectful to other living beings and their necessities for life. And the second rule fell automatically into place. Take care of this place. So you're absolutely right, Robert, in mentioning the fact that good stewardship is considered a sacred responsibility in that regard. So all aspects of it, I believe, are meant to work together. The sacred, the scientific, the indigenous, and Western knowledge. Those things can all be brought to bear to enhance both the human qualities of life and the world around us that bring so much joy and pleasure to the art of living on this planet.
Well, speaking of art, while you did work for a few years as a biologist, you quickly moved to becoming an artist. Can you describe the transition that took place?
Well, you know, there is a period in time when one practices the scientific approach and the collection of objective understanding of the world, confirmation through the collection of data, and fitting them to various hypotheses about how to discover the truth of nature and how it works, and therefore to bring some enlightenment as to direction. I learned in that process, as I began to discover my own roots in indigeneity, place and the methodology whereby Anishinaabe people related to the world quite successfully over thousands of years in this country we call Canada. That had a place too, and I found a great deal of it was more subjective in nature rather than objective. We have a practice and belief in what we call heart-forward thinking, where there is a more subjective relationship, a spiritual one, if you will call it, with all life, all ways of being, and therefore ways of thinking and proceeding in our communities and our societies. In that sense, bringing them together, I think, as a collective, a really operative collective in our whole approach to how we live, is not only how I've needed to go, because that's my experience, but I think it's a good thing for, as a matter of fact, and I involve myself in mentoring at Trent University, for instance, graduate and postgraduate students in these ways of thinking. We call it two-eyed seeing, and it's a good way, I believe.
I'd like to pursue that a little bit more because, forgive me for using sort of a Western approach to this, but it strikes me that, you know, being a scientist is sort of a right brain activity and being an artist is a left brain activity. And somehow you've combined those two things through your art and science. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about how you do that and what it means to you and how you express it.
If you take a goal or an objective approach to things, for instance, as a scientist, it was possible to collect information and become interested in the plight of orcas on the west coast of Canada, which I engaged myself in as an artist to as well. The goal was to bring information, attention, and cast some light and positivity to the direction that we should be exercising on behalf of the Western orca population, in this case in the Sitka River Valley of Northern Vancouver Island. A lot of science was being done there. I was asked at one time to participate with a number of other artists, Bill Reed and Robert Bateman among them, Tony Only, to give voice, I guess you would call it a pictorial voice, to these things. There were also writers there, or there were filmmakers, they were people, a broad range of individuals who could elaborate on, elucidate the whole ecology of that particular situation out there. It was the only part of the world where these killer whales were known to engage in the activity of rubbing themselves on certain beach stones at the mouth of the Sitka River Valley. So we had a big exhibition. A lot of publicity was given to the art that was prepared there. There were documentaries made, books written. We supported the scientific endeavor. We worked together. The net result was that a sanctuary was created for that species. And it became obvious to me then that the subjective and the objective could be harmoniously harnessed to bring a desired result about. And art could support the environment, albeit in a different way than biologists do, or scientists, or environmental managers do. But it was demonstrated that cooperatively we were synergistic, we could achieve something together that we could not achieve or had greater difficulty achieving as separate entities. So that's how this fusion occurred, avoiding, of course, as you alluded to, the schizophrenia of right and left brain thinking. It somehow merged, and that those two separate ways of thinking, being heart forward versus cerebral, would be brought together into a structure, a sort of a matrix of accomplishment and understanding.
I understand that this week you are unveiling a new mural in Port Hope in the Jack Berger Sports Complex. Can you tell us a bit about that?
You are correct. I was approached by the municipality of Port Hope and commissioned subsequently to produce a piece of work which would not only illustrate the important annual return of salmon to the Ganaraska River, but to go back in history somewhat and bring up to date people's understanding that the Mississaugeek people, as we call ourselves, in English known as Mississauga Ojibwe, also had experienced this. So this is a phenomenon that goes on way back through time in the centuries. True, in the old days there were Atlantic salmon coming up from the Atlantic Ocean up the St. Lawrence as far as the they could, I guess that would be Niagara Falls, because they had no way of surmounting Niagara Falls. But in the tributaries and rivers of Lake Ontario, and to a lesser extent, up the Ottawa River, Michisagi, the name actually refers to river mouth people. And in the fall of the year, when the salmon, the Atlantic salmon, returned to the rivers, we would be there. We were sustained in part by them. They were very important to us, as were the migration of other species, like eels, for instance. The last eel disappeared from Rice Lake in 1984, I believe, was the last one caught. If you examine the catch records of eels in Lake Ontario, a similar decline was experienced in that time. Efforts are now being made, some successfully, to reintroduce the Atlantic salmon to the tributaries of Lake Ontario, and simultaneously other Pacific native species like coho, chinook, even sockeye. So while the runs of salmon up the Ganarasca River are altered in species composition from what they used to be, there is still this important connection, and as many people should be aware, the return of the salmon to the Ganarasca River is a well-known local annual event for fishermen, sightseers, etc. And with the installation of the fish ladder at the falls upriver, the dam upriver, some recognition has been given to the importance of having a continuance of that natural spectacle. So I did the painting. I went up and did the research along the Ganarasca River. I saw the salmon running up. It's an amazing sight, a really invigorating, encouraging sight to see these fish coming back to the river. And I did a painting called Coho Homing, about these fish returning to the river. And in the swirl of the rapids moving around the rocks in the background behind the jumping salmon were intimations of presence, historically, of the Michisagi people. And that's what I present to them. That's what I will be presenting and describing at the Jack Berger Complex tomorrow morning. And it will be received and acknowledged by the mayor and the municipality of Port Hope. It was a wonderful engagement. Those kind of things are, they add such a dimension to being a communicator in the visual arena, as I am an artist.
I want to talk for a moment about the modern history of Alderville. Now, so much has been happening in the awareness of by Canadians of Indigenous people, and there's been a lot of ugly history now being brought to light. Of course, there are the efforts of truth and reconciliation, but going forward, what will historians 100 years from now be saying about Alderville?
Well, I would like to think, I have no way of knowing for sure what the perspective will be a century from now about what Alderville is perceived as, but I would hope this. I would hope that they view Alderville's efforts currently to be progressive in many areas, certainly in social development, in the environment, certainly. We do have the Black Oak Savannah and a comprehensive community-wide conservation and assessment program that's incorporated into our planning and development. We have the solar farm, which gives further impetus to our belief in the sustainability efforts that are required for us to move forward into the future in as least obtrusive way as possible. It's a 5 megawatt. It was the first solar farm totally owned by an indigenous community in Canada. And it's providing benefits to our community. We now have more integrated relationships with our surrounding communities, you know, Cobourg and Port Hope. And so as we move forward together in a broader sense of community, this is the only way to go, I feel. We can still have our distinctive and colorful cultural connections. I would hope that people would see that we've done quite a bit to bring those to light, to encourage people's celebration of the achievement of an indigenous community toward adding, I guess, diversity to the Canadian social landscape. And of course, I would like to believe that they view our contributions in the area of the environment, social policy, in a positive light. I would hope, too, that they would see the absolute willingness to forgive. Yes, to understand, to have truth. But at the end of the day, we don't get to where we need to go without forgiveness. And for all the negative things that are being revealed today, the death of children in the residential school system, the roles of the church and government in that genocide, the many murdered and missing indigenous women and children. Yes, there's more work to be done. I would hope in 100 years we have resolved those. We have reduced the incidence of those kind of events. And that we have certainly played our part in helping that happen. Those are the most important things, I think, that I think about. I would like to see us all prosper. I would like to see us all cooperate. I would love it if our mutual energies can be brought together, as I've experienced in my life, to make the world a better place.
Rick Beaver, thank you so much for talking to me today.
You're very welcome, Robert. And I wish all of our listeners a better today and tomorrow. Enjoy it.
That was Rick Beaver, well-known local Indigenous artist and environmentalist living in Alderville. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at ConsiderThisNorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening and stay tuned for more from Consider This.